This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When record producer Phil Spector needed a drummer, he often called my guest Hal Blaine. Those Spector hits are just part of the reason Blaine is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's also played on hits by Leslie Gore, The Beach Boys, Bobby V, Elvis Presley, Dean Martin, Roy Orbison, Johnny Rivers, Sonny and Cher, The Byrds, The Association, The Mamas and the Papas, Petula Clark, Paul Revere and the Raiders, The Supremes, Bobby Darin, Nancy Sinatra, and Frank Sinatra. Blaine is featured on thousands of records and over 40 number one hits. In 1963 alone, he played on Then He Kissed Me, The Do-Run-Run, Another Saturday Night, Surf City, Surfer Girl, Surfin' USA, and this record, which has one of rock and roll's most famous opening drum lines. Hal Blaine, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Now, is the opening on Be My Baby, was that drum line your idea?
You know, that's a very difficult question to answer because Jack Nitzsche was a pretty prolific writer, but he wrote very, very thin in those days. You know, this was the beginnings of rock and roll. Somehow, with my experience, I keep thinking that I was an awfully good faker, and it could be that the lick went boom, 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 with a backbeat, boom, 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 and at one point while we were rolling, I may have missed the second beat, so we went boom, 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 and it stuck. It became a hook, and of course, one of the most famous hooks in rock and roll. That also happened to me, just to get off the beaten track. It also happened to me with the Tijuana Brass when we did A Taste of Honey. The song, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and everybody comes in, da-da-da-da-da. Well, unfortunately, nobody was coming in together. It was like a train wreck. So at one point, me and my comedic mind, they went ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I looked at the band, and I started slugging with my bass drum. Boom, 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 diddly, 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 diddly. Everybody came in, and once again, that became a major hook for that song. It happened to be my first record of the year.
Why don't we hear that part you're talking about? Blaine, what are some of the other records that had the most memorable beats that you played?
Well, I remember doing a record with Tommy Rowe. The record was called Dizzy. That was another one where I played a kind of a hook drum sound. Boom, dink, digga 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 ding, dink, digga 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 digga. Over and over, I found that by doing, I learned very quickly in the early days of rock and roll, that there were certain hooks that people wanted to go with, guitar players or bass players. And I found that I could do that with drums, and it worked beautifully. by repeating a particular, every four bars or every eight bars, repeating a particular lick. One of the great records that I did with Sam Cooke was Saturday Night, Another Saturday Night, it was called. And that was another one with that same drum lick every eight or 16 bars, whatever it was. Dig-a-dig-dig-dig-dig-dig-dig-dig. And, you know, all these drum licks kind of became the standard for rock and roll. All the drummers that I've spoken with through the years have told me that they grew up listening to the records that I played on, and that's how they learned. And I grew up listening to Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich, and that's how I learned.
In fact, I bet you've been to countless restaurants where people have been playing your rhythms on the table.
That has happened, I guess, in the past. You know, sometimes I've actually, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I've actually turned around to someone and said, do me a favor and let me play the drums. In a nice way.
Right.
Where I would explain to them that they were trying to play their fingers along with whatever the music was playing, coming out of the speakers in the restaurant. That actually has happened to me, which is kind of funny that you would hit on that.
My guest is Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, drummer Hal Blaine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Hal Blaine, one of rock and roll's most celebrated session drummers. He's played on many Phil Spector sessions, as well as recordings by the Beach Boys, Leslie Gore, Roy Orbison, Johnny Rivers, the Byrds, the Mamas and the Papas, the Supremes, and Bobby Darin. Now, you did a lot of records with Phil Spector, including Be My Baby.
Yes.
What are some of the things he had you do that other session heads didn't? What was different about working with Phil Spector?
Well, first of all, every Phil Spector session was a party. Everyone on the session, all the guys and girls, were the first call people, the A, if you would, the A gang. Everyone wanted to work with Phil Spector because they knew that some kind of a hit record, I mean, it was the talk of the town. Phil Spector was the guy that everyone wanted to see how he worked. He had a big sign on the door that said closed session, and yet anyone who stuck their head in, he'd grab him and he'd shove him in the studio and he'd say, Hal, give him a tambourine or a shaker or some clavies, some noisemakers, let him play something.
The musicians who you used to play with on rock and roll sessions were known as the Wrecking Crew. Why were they called the Wrecking Crew?
In the late 50s, we started playing rock and roll, and a lot of people said it was a dirty word. They didn't want to hear that kind of music. They thought the musicians were just rank amateurs. They had no idea that we were all well-learned and studied musicians with degrees and so forth playing music. And the old-timers, the guys that we kind of replaced, used to say, these kids are going to wreck the business. And I just automatically started calling us the Wrecking Crew. And then I became a contractor very early on. And doing the hiring for the sessions that I was playing on. And I just started, you know, people would call me and they'd say, get your crew together. And I'd say, okay, the Wrecking Crew, here we go. And I'd make calls. Eventually I had a secretary who made all my calls and so forth. So the Wrecking Crew stuck.
What kind of, would you get like sheet music? What kind of, how clear was it to you what they wanted you to play or how much improvising did you do?
The music that was handed us physically were usually chord sheets.
Mm-hmm.
Chord charts are just, they're just road maps starting at, you know, at the top and going through to the end with certain stops in between. It's just like any other road map. The things with, generally, we were hired for our expertise as such. We could do anything we wanted to do. And if any of it was offensive in any way, we would be told, don't play this or don't play that, or, you know, I like this lick or I don't like that lick.
Did Spector hum for you or clap for you the kind of things that he wanted, the sound that he wanted?
Not on drum, not for drums. Phil used to use me like a racehorse. He would have me sitting there while he rehearsed. he would keep me from rehearsing, and I'd be chomping at the bit I want to play. And finally, he would point to me. He used to be in the booth, and he'd run back and forth. They had a huge window, and he'd run back and forth like he was conducting a symphony, and he'd look at the strings and use certain, you know, symphonic movements or the way a conductor would do. And he knew certain times he would look at me, and he would say, "Now." And I knew he was saying "now," which meant go for it. And I guess I used to go nuts sometimes on those drums, because if you listen to some of the fade endings on just about all those records, we used to go into double times and all kinds of things that were not unheard of on records. And everybody would go wacko. And then there was a time when Phil threatened to put out a record or an album of all the fades that we did. And the fades, if for those who don't know what a fade is, it just means when you hear a record playing and it gets to the end and it gets softer and softer and softer and softer, and it's gone. That's called the fade. With Phil, it went on forever. And finally, when everyone had had enough, and I always kind of had that feeling, I knew when it was, I would go into my quarter note triplets against whatever was being played.
Clap a quarter note triplet for us.
Well, in other words, it's over, and I go da 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 da. So everyone knew, here it is, this is it. And Phil would never stop the machine until I played those quarter note triplets. So they're on the end of every record.
Now you were the drummer on a lot of the Beach Boys records.
Just about all.
But I think it was Dennis who was actually the drummer with the band. I imagine at the time nobody knew that he wasn't the drummer on the records.
A lot of people did not know in the early days that Dennis did not play on those things. Sometimes Dennis would come in and overdub a tambourine or something. But Dennis happened to be a friend of mine, and we each had our yachts very close to each other. We were both motorcyclists. But Brian used to come into the Spectre sessions. He wanted to see what so many people wanted to see. They wanted to know what we used to refer to as sprinkling the fairy dust on this tape that made it a hit record, that Phil Spector seemed to everything he touched were hits. And obviously after about the second or third record that we did with Phil, you couldn't get in the studio, but everybody wanted to know who was this Phil Spector? What was he doing?
So you met Brian Wilson at Phil Spector sessions because Brian Wilson wanted to see what Spector was up to?
Right. Brian used to come in and see us. We were introduced at the time. I think at the time Brian might have mentioned the fact that, boy, I'd like to have you play for me sometime. And I said, sure, you know, I play for everybody. It was not a problem. I was also working with these other kids called Jan and Dean, major rock stars in those days. And, in fact, the Beach Boys used to come in and sing on Jan and Dean's record sometimes. Jan and Dean would go over and sing on the Beach Boys record sometimes. A lot of people didn't know that.
So did Dennis feel bad that instead of you on the records?
I tell you, I've told the story before. Dennis loved the fact that while I was in the studio in the afternoon making $35, $40 for the afternoon, Dennis, that night, was making $35,000 or $40,000 on stage. I mean, they were making a lot of money. And he was thrilled that he could just be on his boat. He didn't have to be in the studio. He didn't have to rehearse.
Well, let me rephrase the question. Did you feel resentful then that he was making all this money on stage and you were making next to nothing in the studio?
Not at all, because I knew what it was leading to, because my phone started ringing off the hook from Phil Spector dates and Beach Boys dates.
Right.
All of a sudden, I was getting calls for Elvis Presley and Johnny Rivers, and Fifth Dimension came along, and Mamas and the Papas. I mean, everybody came out of the woodwork.
Is there a Beach Boys track that you particularly like your drumming on that we can play?
Well, you know, I'd have to think about that a little bit. There are certain songs that make you cry. Songs like God Only Knows, one of the beautiful songs. Good Vibrations, of course, was another sort of a trilogy of Brian put that song together. Sometimes we would do, you know, 5 minutes on a session, and he'd say thank you, and sometimes we would work for days putting that song together. He just used to use little bits and pieces of this, that, and the other. I remember that on one of the sessions, and I think it was part of the Good Vibrations, Brian wanted something different, a different sound with drums or percussion. We used to drink a lot of orange juice, and they came in little small bottles out of a vending machine. And I took three of those bottles, taped them together, cut the tops off to various sizes, almost like the tubes on a vibraphone. And there were three different sounds, and I used a mallet that would be used on a vibraphone, and I got this knocking sound. Three different knocking sounds. And I used it on that section where we were playing ba-da-dat, boo-doo-doo, ba-da-dat. Well, I was playing ba-da-da, ba-da-da, different tones.
Why don't we hear that part of Good Vibrations? This is Hal Blaine.
I love the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me excitations. I'm backing up good vibrations. She's giving me excitations. I'm backing up good vibrations. She's giving me excitations. I'm backing up good vibrations. She's giving me excitations.
Was Hal Blaine on drums and percussion? Now, Hal Blaine, we've been talking about your rock and roll sessions. You also worked with Sinatra. Did you have to get a different kind of beat when you were working with Sinatra? As a jazz singer, Sinatra was more behind the beat. Rock and roll tends to be very on the beat.
Well, one of our secrets to rock and roll was learning to lay back. And we used to, in other words, if you were looking at a scale on a ruler, every time your backbeat came on, one, two, three, four, every time we'd hit two and four, it would be just a hair behind that actual two and four. That was how I got the great feeling going all the time with Joe Osborne, the great bass player, and Larry Nechtel. You know, we were known as the three killers who used to come in and make these, like, Bridge Over Troubled Water records like that were just so incredible. All Grammy winners.
My guest is Rock and Roll Hall of Famer drummer Hal Blaine. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Hal Blaine, one of rock and roll's most celebrated session drummers. When we left off, we were talking about recording with Frank Sinatra.
You mentioned Be My Baby. Boom, 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 bang, boom, 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 bang. When I did the record Strangers in the Night with Frank, which was record of the year, and his only gold single, believe it or not, that went right to number one, I was playing the same beat quietly. Strangers in the Night, boom, ba-ba-ba-ba, boom, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, boom.
Strangers in the Night, exchanging glances, wandering in the night. What were the chances we'd be sharing love? before the night was through. Something in your
What was the rehearsal like with Sinatra, and what was the recording session like?
Well, generally, when you got a Sinatra call, it was a six-hour call. Now, the standard is a three-hour session. With Frank Sinatra, we would have a six-hour double session call. 3 hours, an hour break, and then 3 hours of recording. Now, the reason for that was that in this case, Jimmy Bowen, who was producing, we would go in for the first 3 hours and rehearse whatever the song or songs were to make sure that we absolutely had it down pat. The engineers would go through all the lines to make sure that there were no glitches, no squeaks, no white noise, no red noise. They would go through all the chairs that the strings especially were sitting on, make sure that there were no squeaks, make sure that everyone had the lights on their music stands, no music stand rattles. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Because when Frank Sinatra walked in to record, he walked around with two, three of us, four of us, said, "Hi, how you doing? Let's make a record." And bang, he was in the vocal booth and we were making a record. No fooling around, no mistakes, no nothing. Rarely did he ask to do a second take. Frank always knew what he was doing. He had rehearsed himself. He knew the songs. And it was unbelievable.
Say somebody else required a second take because they made a mistake. Would he get annoyed?
You know, we never said anything, because by the time we were working with Frank, they could do a lot of things electronically. If a guy had a glitch, in the string section, they could somehow key him out, overdub him, and fix it up. Frank was the kind of guy that once he walked out of the vocal booth, he'd say, "Thank you all." He was gone with his entourage. That was it. I think it was only once that Frank Sinatra, I heard him say, "Jimmy, I really would like to do one more take, please, if you don't mind." And, of course, we would do one more take. And, instead of the full 3 hours, he would work for 15 minutes, and then it was over with.
You've been on about 8,000 different songs that have been recorded. Do you actually remember what you were on? Or do you have to consult a list to figure out if you were on something?
Well, it depends. Obviously, I had all those records of the year, the Grammy winner of the year, and I don't have to think about those records. I know those records backwards. When it comes to certain songs, there are certain songs out there that I didn't even realize. I mean, when I was working with people like Dusty Springfield, I couldn't even tell you the song or songs. It was just a blur of so many songs and so many sessions. I don't know. It's very difficult to explain, Terry. I just played what I felt, and they let me play. You know, once you kind of make a name for yourself, then when producers would come in, they would say, "Oh, Hal, just do your thing. You know, don't worry about it. Just whatever you feel." They felt that I would always do the right thing.
Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Hal Blaine.